You're listening to the Master Passive Income Podcast Network.
Ever get the feeling that the government doesn't really have your back? Well, that's probably because the state has its own agenda, and it rarely aligns with yours as an investor or an operator. This is an episode about unpacking those contradictions so you can stop expecting the system to help you and start playing the game that actually exists. Hey, real estate fan, and welcome to another episode of Real Escape Investing.
Welcome to the Real Escape Investing Podcast, where we guide you to escape the constraints of time, geography, and finance through real estate. And now, here's your host, Terry Schauer.
Estate fan, and welcome to another episode of Real Escape Investing. This week, I want to talk about something, or I feel like I've actually been kind of called to talk about something, and that is the misalignment of objectives between a lot of us as investors and citizens, and what is happening with a lot of different layers of government. And more, as I walk around the city and see things happening, and as I have conversations with other people around me, my colleagues, my friends, the kids at soccer practice, not the kids, the parents at soccer practice, I should say, rather, it occurs to me more and more that there is this kind of misalignment of objectives. And I think that it's something that gets lost in our mental models and in a lot of the frustration and conversations we have, because it's as if a lot of us are walking around expecting that the state and that the municipal or provincial or federal government is going to have our back. And so we spend a lot of time and mental energy complaining to ourselves and each other about things that we feel are not going maybe the way that we would want them to, or policies that maybe we feel like we could do a better job of creating ourselves, or that, things of that nature. But that what I actually want to do in this episode is to unpack some of that mental modeling, to give you some really concrete examples about this misalignment of objectives, and then to give you some tactical tools that will allow you to stop expecting help and help you start to build your own leverage in an environment that ultimately is not necessarily supportive of your goals as an investor, a business person, and also as an individual citizen. And before I get into some of those specific examples, I do want to just share with you part of my purpose in doing this show, and also the way that you can use it to the best of your advantage. So rather than having a political opinion or trying to offer critique or like this is how it should be, what I'm trying to do is to highlight specific things and then give you concrete tips or avenues of thought that will encourage you to take action that's actually going to better your circumstances, as opposed to put a lot of energy into counterproductive frustration. And then while we're on the topic of taking action, one of the other things that I've done to help like-minded individuals and real estate investors move forward with what they're doing is I founded the Equity Builders Club. And once a month, we have networking events in Montreal that are open to everyone. You can come and join us if you want to learn about the next event, which will be at this point in October by the time that this airs. You can go ahead to our website, which is equitybuildersclub.com/events, and you can use my promo code. So that is ML5. That's the acronym of my book, Mindful Landlord, which is available on Amazon. So you can use the promo code ML5 to get a $5 discount on your next event ticket. And I would love to have you join me and my real estate community of people who are interested in advancing and getting better, developing as investors. Once a month, we have these meetups to stay connected, build the community, and help everybody move forward together. So if you're in the Montreal area, and even if you're not, I would love it if you would come and join me at our next event. But so now let's dive into some of the meat of the show. And the place where I really kind of got the inspiration for this episode is that last week I did a show on the CMHC, so that's the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, which is the government mortgage insurer that insures a lot of mortgages, whether it's residential or multifamily mortgages. And so because of the type of things that they fund and the way that they structure their mortgage insurance, this agency has really a lot of power over how residential housing markets function and also how investment in multifamily assets takes place in Canada. So they're really, quite powerful. And the other thing that the CMHC does, which is interesting, is to put out different kinds of research and reports on various subjects that are affecting Canadian investors and the Canadian public. And so last week, I was very interested to receive an email in my inbox from the CMHC saying that they had done a three-part series on eviction. And I thought, okay, well, this is interesting because, anecdotally, I'm aware that evictions are on the rise. At the same time as anecdotally, I'm also aware that mental health issues and drug addiction are issues that are on the rise, as well as housing affordability has gone down. So I thought, okay, well, I want to see what the CMHC has to say because they have access to huge data sets. And so very often it's very interesting to read their reports and see what's going on. And then as I began to read their three-part reports, I was really frustrated by the way in which those reports were framed and even the topics that were researched by them. So if you want to have a more in-depth look at this, you can kind of go back and listen to the show from last week. But if I was to summarize really quickly, the CMHC funded the research essentially to see the outcomes for evicted tenants. And, let's say the chances are that they would, continue to be homeless after they were evicted, their mental health and drug addictions could be affected. But the focus is really on the outcomes for evicted tenants and not, for example, on the cost of eviction for property owners. There was also no attention paid whatsoever on the potential scenarios leading up to eviction, because I will tell you anecdotally, people don't just get evicted from one day to the next. You have to go through a whole court proceeding. And, myself and the other property owners that I know, by the time we have recourse to evictions, it's because there have been police reports, property damage, because the rent has been unpaid usually for months, or because there are some other nuisance issues, whether it's conflict with the neighbors, conflict between the tenant and us as the landlords, sanitation issues, pest control issues, where something that the tenant is doing is degrading the property. So either damaging your investment, my investment, or else damaging the quality of life that the other tenants in the building have, and thereby, ruining kind of their enjoyment of the place. And as a byproduct, then ruining the level of your investment or the value of your investment, because what it's doing is it's bringing down the property value. And then ultimately, because the building becomes a place where no good tenant wants to live, then the good tenants end up leaving because there's someone in the building who's creating problems, whether it's dealing drugs or bringing pests into the building that you can't get rid of because they don't collaborate with pest control, whatever it is. This is my experience of evictions from the side of the landlord. But, when you look at the research that the CMHC is funding, there was no interest in this whatsoever. So no quantification of the financial costs of evictions, no quantification of what is the typical trajectory that a property owner must go through before an eviction takes place. And so what this tells me is that to expect a neutral or balanced lens and to think that the research that the CMHC is funding, because let's face it, to scrape all of this data, process it, put out reports, and then email all of us who are on their mailing list, that is an action that costs money and takes resources. And if you're shining the light on the issue of eviction in a very specific way, the goal is to have some sort of political interest. And, who is it that reads those reports? Well, ultimately, it's people from the industry. So it will be investors like myself and yourself. It will be bankers. It will be economists. It will be people who are, involved in decision-making in the real estate industry. And by choosing to fund a report that really only looks at the outcomes for the individual tenants and then looks at the demographics of those tenants, to see, who is being evicted disproportionately, what groups of people, what sort of vulnerabilities make it likely that someone's going to be evicted. That's really focusing on the interests of the individual tenants as opposed to the interests of the investors and the landlords, or the interest of, you know, the other residents of buildings and stuff like that. So, you know, by shining the light in one place and deploying resources to shine the light on that specific place, what we're not doing is focusing on the interests of everybody else in the picture and trying to influence the political landscape, influence public opinion in the direction of those evicted individuals, as opposed to looking at a big picture where you're looking at what are the negative effects of those like really socially uncollaborative behaviors that end up getting someone evicted in the first place. So, you know, this is kind of where I want to start that. And it was with this like gut negative emotional reaction to those reports as I read them, and then beginning to think through like, why is it that this is how those resources are getting deployed? And to think that as investors and business people and ordinary citizens, that the governments, the different levels of government are aligned with our interests is really a bit naive. And it's also not going to help you. It's not going to help me move our own objectives forward. And so in a sense, that's the topic of this show, is I want you to walk away from this with a view to, when you see something like this that, you know, you might have a negative gut reaction to emotionally, is look at it in such a way where you're thinking about, okay, well, whose objectives are being represented here? And how are those not necessarily aligned with my objectives? And what am I going to do? What kind of action am I going to take to, you know, make sure that I'm advancing my own goals? And if this eviction example is a little bit too esoteric or a little bit, you know, too abstract and difficult to understand, I wanted to pull another example, which I think, you know, I am at the time of this recording sitting in my home in Montreal, in Quebec. And as a member of the Quebec Anglophone community, who in an unashamed way educates my son in English, I did want to like just, you know, bring up this example as another way of thinking through how the goals of individual citizens and what they, let's say, want to do with their kids' education is not going to be necessarily aligned with decisions that are made by the provincial government. So, you know, many immigrant families that I know would like to send their kids to English school in order to prepare them for the competitive, globalizing job market, and it to open the horizons onto them that if they want to work in Ontario, in the US, with Americans, with people from Ontario, that they have a level of English that allows them to do this. And as those of us, you know, who are involved in this environment know, Quebec won't allow parents to educate their children in English language institutions unless the parents themselves were educated in English. And, you know, I have a story about this where, you know, for myself and my brother to be able to go to English school, my mom had to get her primary school certificate sent over from South Africa to prove that we had actually been educated in English so that we would have the privilege to go to English school in Quebec. And so when you think about the fact that from an individual family's perspective, it's to, you know, the parents and the kids' advantage to be able to pick the language that they want to educate their kids in and to give them a head start in English, which honestly is the language of business and of the international community, and that the Quebec government makes a decision to make that difficult for kids and for families to have their kids come out of school with a decent level of English, well, that's a clear misalignment of objectives. Because, you know, obviously for all the immigrant families and non-immigrant families who want to educate their kids in English, who have had that particular avenue shut off for them, it's not in their best interest and in their kids' best interest to, you know, have them come out of school with maybe a great level of French, but not the best level of English. And that if, you know, your reaction to this is to sit and think, well, you know, this is frustrating and I'm going to wait for the next election to try to get the party out of power who makes these decisions. Like, I just don't know that that would be how I would try to get leverage in that situation for, you know, trying to give my kids the best possible chance to be educated in English if I, you know, didn't have the right to do that. And so this is not a language law episode, but I just wanted to pick a really clear example where it's obvious that whatever decisions are being made by the provincial government to try to, you know, preserve Quebec culture, have it remain French, have them, you know, keep their grips on public opinion by forcing everyone to only think in French, that this is really at odds with what the objectives of individual families might be. And that if I were, to find myself in this particular type of situation where I wanted to educate my kid in English and I couldn't, well, the first thing I would do is to try to hack the system and figure out, you know, what can I do to get them those privileges? Do I need to save up for private school that doesn't, require any money from the Quebec government, and that after a certain number of years, your kid acquires that eligibility just because they have done a certain number of years of schooling in English language school. And so like whatever it would be that I could do to hack that, I would be sure to think through how can I pull through my own objectives in light of the fact that there is a misalignment of priorities between what in this case the provincial government is trying to force people to do, what I think is the good of my kids and my family and their future, right? So I wanted to pick a really clear example to show you where there is a misalignment between what a certain level of government is doing and what our personal objectives might be as parents. But the other thing I want to do now is to look at some more real estate and municipal politics specific examples, which are going to show you just the absurdity of this. So I was driving home yesterday, and on the highway, I drive home along the 15 South, and I saw a giant billboard for the STM. And I don't remember exactly what it was. So that's our public transit service here in Montreal. And so I got triggered when I saw this because I'm like, okay, so someone somewhere decided to allocate, you know, a certain amount of public money to put a billboard up on the highway where people usually sit in traffic that is advertising for the public transit network. And so I did some checking and I discovered that to put up that billboard at that place on the highway, it costs about $10,000 for a 4-week ad. Now, anecdotally, I know that a lot of people around me have stopped taking the metro because it's basically become a homeless shelter or an open air toilet for people who want to, you know, I guess people who have no other choice to go in and pee. In winter, I have also colleagues of mine who take the metro tell me that they have to be like walking over homeless people as they're going in and out of the metro station, and that because they don't feel safe and because this is unpleasant, they have now stopped taking the metro. And so I just find it really funny that the, public transit system is now putting up advertising to try to encourage people to make the ecological choice and take public transit, while at the same time, our transit system has been allowed to degenerate to the point where people don't actually feel safe taking it anymore because there's such a high rate of, drug addicted homeless people who are now being allowed to hang out in and around the transit stations. And so the other thing that I did, and because I thought that this was really funny when you think about the way in which those resources are being allocated, I took that $10,000 money that was spent on the billboard and divided it by 12. So to figure out who I could house with that amount of money. And so in my cheapest apartment, I could house one homeless person in my cheapest bachelor apartment for 1 year with the cost of that billboard. And if they were to be housed in a rooming house, so like the cost of having someone stay in a rooming house is probably about half of what it costs for them to rent a bachelor apartment. Well, that means that with the cost of putting up that ad on the highway, two homeless people could be housed in a rooming house, thereby making the metro and the public transit system, that much more pleasant to use, as opposed to trying to put up ads and encourage people to take a system that is basically overrun because of social issues. When you think about it, those misalignments of objectives and the way in which public funds are being used, it's kind of a funny situation. Because when you think it through, somebody made a decision to spend that budget on advertising as opposed to spending it in a very uncontroversial way on cleaning up the transit system, which from my perspective, by word of mouth, would encourage way more people to take transit than a silly advertising board. And what I wanted to do is from here to have kind of a nice segue into the question of rooming houses, because I was actually reading Ezra Klein's book, Abundance, the other day, and he has a really interesting chapter on housing. Now, it's not obviously tailored to our Canadian context because he's really focusing on what happened in the US, but I think that what I found very interesting is that with all of this debate about affordable housing and, you know, the outcry from municipal politics, politicians about how, you know, the investors and the landlords are and housing affordability is being eroded and how this is like creating, you know, a real homelessness crisis. Well, I think if we focus on rooming houses and the way in which those types of accommodation have really been sidelined over the past few years. Well, like, I think that that's another, you know, interesting thing to look at and to think through where there is this misalignment of objectives. So anecdotally, when I started investing, my first property was a triplex in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, which is like one of the, you know, kind of more rundown areas of Montreal. And at the time, my neighbors, which were actually, my triplex that I bought had been a sixplex before. And the sixplex that it would had been divided into, the other half of it was actually a rooming house. And, you know, at the time, I think they were renting those rooms, which included a small kitchenette and a shared bathroom. They were renting those for like $400. And the people who lived in there, like a lot of them were kind of, you know, older alcoholics, but they were not in any way disturbing. And somebody was, you know, running that rooming house. And so myself having taken over the other half of it, so my half of the triplex had been transformed into rental apartments, but the architectural configuration inside was still that of a rooming house. And basically what I was doing at the time was renting out rooms to foreign students. And so innocent, you know, Terry, who started out investing, then went down to the city office and asked, okay, well, can I transform my building back into a rooming house? And what I met with there in terms of the city regulation, zoning laws, fire codes, and it just seemed to me also like a general political unwillingness to support that kind of housing, I discovered that to, you know, transform my property back into a rooming house and thereby to put more affordable housing onto the market really would have been so cost prohibitive because of all the city regulations that had been added on top of how those properties have to be built out with fire codes and architectural plans and all this different kind of stuff, that I just let the project go because it would have been too much trouble. And so when you add that to the fact that, you know, banks and even the CMHC does not really want to support private landlords buying up rooming houses, well, what's happening is that that sort of transitional type of housing is basically being starved off the market by municipal policies and also banking policies. And that the bottom line is that if you want to house the most vulnerable, you know, the easiest thing to do would be to encourage rooming houses, which actually from an investor's perspective are super lucrative. So, I mean, obviously from a management perspective, it's complicated to run a rooming house just because there's a lot of turnover and you end up dealing with a lot of social issues in there. But from a perspective of making money, owning rooming houses actually allows you to make a very nice cash flow with owning just a few assets. So the end of the rooming house era is really a question of municipal politics and policies, and then also decisions made by individual banks on what sort of property they're going to finance. So typically, banks will not finance rooming houses where it's not some kind of strange case where the owner lives in there or it's a long-term care home. But if it's not one of those weird cases, the bank is probably not going to finance it. And by default, that means that it's really difficult for rooming houses to continue existing because when you want to transact them, it's virtually impossible to find financing for them, let alone to obtain municipal permits to do any kind of modifications or, heaven forbid, to put any more rooming houses on the market. And so when you think about what our goals or what our, you know, objectives might be as investors, which is ultimately to buy assets that make money, general citizens might have the objective of having less homeless people on the street and having more affordable housing on the market, but that ultimately the municipal politicians and the CMHC is making decisions that have that type of residential tenure really just be eradicated because it's not possible to build it and then to finance it. So it's kind of interesting just to think about how different levels of government don't necessarily have your best interest and the citizens' best interest at heart. And, you know, again, to tell you kind of another anecdote on this, in various episodes, I've talked about my struggles with the city trying to get a permit to add another suite to my single family home. And at the time of this recording, I have now spent $20,000 in architect's fees and permitting fees trying to build a suite in my own home. Now, if we do that calculation again, that if I was to invest that money in housing, homeless people in a rooming house, well, with that $20,000 that I have had to spend in permitting fees and in an architect who I'm really weaponizing to fight the city, right? Because I want to build my addition in a certain way and they're making my life complicated. And so every time they tell me you have to redraw this, you have to redraw that, it ends up costing me more in architect's fees. And so that $20,000 could house four homeless people in a rooming house for 1 year, but instead I'm spending it on architect's fees and permitting fees. And just that you have an idea of where that $20,000 went. So the city was asking for a vegetalization plan of the backyard, because obviously the first architect's drawing that shows that we're going to plant grass is not good enough. They need a full color 3D plan of where all the plants are going to go. They then need a equinox sun trajectory study to show that the suite that I'm adding is not going to throw shade on the neighbors or the backyard or the street in any weird way. And then we're also engaged in a struggle over the type of garage door that I can install, because I want to have a garage door that has some windows and the city doesn't want those windows. And so now I have to prepare a whole, argument to get the kind of garage door that I want to have. And so when you think about the fact that, the municipal government obviously is not aligned with the goal of having more rental units on the market, because if they were, they would not be placing the bar so high in terms of what you can do, what you can create, and my extra suite isn't built yet. So the result of that is, with that $20,000, I could have housed four tenants in a rooming house. And had they not thrown up all of those different problems for me, then that extra street would already be built. And so right now there's one less unit in the rental pool as a result of these regulatory proceedings. And you really don't have to go very far to see this, right? Because there's this now citywide objective to have everyone put fences around their swimming pools. And so like everybody I know who has a swimming pool in their rental units in their houses is running around like a headless chicken trying to get their fence installed before the city inspectors can come and give them a ticket for that. But just think about the amount of people that the city has had to hire to enforce this swimming pool fence situation. And if you combine that with the fact that somebody looked into this actually, and there's an interesting data point, which is that I think it's in the past 3 years, there were 21 drownings in the city. And only four of those were in pools that did not have fences. So the vast majority of drownings in the city, 15 out of 21, took place in pools that had fences. Only four of them happened in pools that were unfenced. And so, you know, when you think about the resources that the city is deploying on a grand scale to enforce this bylaw, and I would love to know the budget of that, because then I would tell you how many homeless people they could house with it. And anyway, so all of this to show you that there is really a misalignment between the objectives of us as investors and business people who, our goal, obviously the purpose of investing is to make money. And then ultimately, if you're doing real estate investing, hopefully you're either putting housing supply onto the market that the market needs, because otherwise the market's going to punish you. Like just right now, if you know that, in the high end condo market, their vacancy rates are at like over 5%. So 5 or 6% vacancy rate on high-end units, whereas affordable units have less than 1% vacancy. So ultimately, as an investor, if you want to make intelligent decisions, like you know that you need to be supplying affordable housing and maybe not condos. So, you know, for us who look at that, we make our decisions and decide, okay, well, this is the type of asset class that I want to own and offer to the market because there's really a need for it. Whereas if you look at the way that the decisions are made by different levels of government, they will have objectives because they're their own little ecosystems that are running programs that are not the same type of program as we will have. And so, you know, every 4 years we get the right to vote in municipal elections or provincial elections or federal elections, but that like ultimately the everyday quality of your life and the everyday decision making that you're doing really is not going to have much of an effect on those different levels of government. And so my advice to you, investor, business owner, private citizen, is to understand how the game operates, and then don't spend energy, you know, getting angry at these things. I say that after I spent half an hour telling you about all my anecdotal frustration, but that ultimately the best course of action is to understand how those systems function and then find the holes or hack them so that you're able to, you know, pursue your goals and objectives that will make sense in terms of the quality of your own life. To wrap this up and conclude this episode, I really want to, you know, kind of tell you that the current purpose of the show to highlight some of those misalignments of objectives and to give you tactical awareness of where some of the holes might be or the way in which you need to analyze and strategize to be able to pursue your goals irrespective of what the you know, different levels of government are doing in terms of their decision making. And that, you know, if you want to build alliances and take action and have other people around you who are on the same path as you, you do not want to be waiting for permission. You want to be creating leverage and taking action. And that's where I want to leave the episode, which is that you can please come and join us at our next Equity Builders Club networking event. So we have one a month. And the purpose of that community is really to bring like-minded individuals together who want to grow in this field and develop financial independence, to also have support and community around them of other people who understand the type of game that we're playing to help further our objectives as investors and business people. And yes, sometimes once in a while, private citizens as well. So you can grab a ticket for our next event at equitybuildersclub.com/events. You can use my promo code ML5. That's Mindful Landlord, like my book. That's where the promo code comes from. ML5 to get $5 off your next ticket. And of course, if you enjoyed this episode, if you think anyone could profit from listening to it, please go ahead and share it with them. The other thing you can do to help us with the show is to leave a 5-star review, or else grab the phone of your husband, your wife, your kids, your friends, whoever you're hanging out with. Go ahead and subscribe them to the show. That helps us get the word out to more people. And until next time, real estate fan, join me next week for another episode of Real Escape Investing.